Welcome to episode 56 of Meenal's World. Thank you all again for joining me this week, where I have the privilege on this podcast to share the wisdom and learnings from change makers, activists, and the greatest thinkers of our generation. And as always, none of this would be possible without the generosity of my guests who give me their time and energy every week. Remember, I also have a newsletter that you can subscribe to. All the details are on my website, meenalviz.com, where you can sign up, and I promise it won't take more than 60 seconds. This week, I had the pleasure and honour to speak to someone I've looked up to for years. George Monbiot is a writer and activist who's created headlines all over the world, including Indonesia, and we'll get into that more in this episode. In 1995, Nelson Mandela presented him with a United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement. In this episode, I speak to George about all of the experiences that shaped him as an activist and investigative journalist. And we go way back into his childhood, and we talk about how all of this started from as young as the age of 6. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did recording with George. So without further ado, here's George Monbiot. Welcome to the show, George. Thank you so much for your time, and it's a true pleasure to have one of the greatest activists of our generation on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Meenal. It's a real privilege. Thanks.
I remember the first time I saw that you followed me on Twitter, and I was quite heavily pregnant at that time, and my husband was at work, and I called him and I said, guess what's happened? And he thought that, like, I had given birth or something. I said, George Monbiot was following me. So I'm a big fan of your work, George, and I think you've inspired not just me, but so many people in our generation. As I read about you, I realized that this is not something that just started recently when you were starting your work in journalism, but it actually started from as young as the age of 6. I remember reading that at the age of 6, you saw that they were cutting down trees and you didn't like that. And you went and you hugged the tree, and you stopped it from being cut down. So it starts from a very young age.
Yeah, I think I was 8, but I can't be dead sure. It was sometime around then. But anyway, yes, I was really angry about it. I was already quite aware of what was going on in the world. And then seeing this beautiful tree, it was an old cherry tree, a hollow tree, with a woodpecker's nest in it, a nest of green woodpeckers. And this guy had a license to cut down what were considered to be the rotten trees, the useless trees, on the common close to where I lived. And I happened to be there as he turned up with his chainsaw to cut this tree down. And of course, the trees that a forester might consider to be rotten are the trees which are best for wildlife. There's an old ecologist phrase that there's more life in a dead tree than in a living one. And in fact, we need a huge variety of trees in various states of morbidity because each state supports a completely different ecosystem, different fungi, different insects. And you need trees with lots of holes in them so that loads of different birds and bats and insects and other species can roost and nest in them. And yet we have this sort of tidy-minded attitude that everything's got to be regular. And we have a similar attitude, I think, in society. You know, it's like sort of cut down all the dead wood, cut down all the things that don't fit in. And I didn't fit in. And I think I always had a certain empathy with everything that was irregular and weird because I was a bit like that myself.
Well, at the age of 8, George, it's something to have that sort of awareness of your surroundings and the environment and the world. And how do you think that came about at such a young age? Was it the books that you were reading? Was it the family conversations you were having?
Well, apparently it was there from the very beginning. Even when I was in my pram, apparently I was fascinated by birds. I was just like, whenever I saw a bird, I completely locked on and couldn't let go. I was just totally there. My grandma was very into nature, and she helped to sort of reinforce that. And she'd take me bird watching and plant spotting and all sorts of things. And she was a tough woman, not a gentle one, but I mean, she was great in many ways because she just sort of, you know, was out in all weathers and just learning constantly all her life about the countryside. And while she wasn't an easy person, I always had great times with her, and it was really like the high point of my holidays when I went and stayed with her.
I know that your family worked quite a lot in politics, and politics seemed to be at the heart of your family. Both your parents were involved with the Conservative Party. And do you think that played a role in your desire to speak truth to power and to actually create change? Was that one of the driving forces?
Through them, I met a lot of creepy people. I mean, really creepy people. And even as a kid, me and my sister, the same. It was like, who are these creeps? Oh, it's the local Conservative Party, so-and-so. And it was like, these are, every person we're meeting here are the people we would not want anything to do with. And I became rather fascinated by them. You know, who are these really quite disturbing people? And what do they believe, and what do they want? What are they after? And as a kid, you're a bit of an anthropologist. You know, you're constantly trying to find out about the adult world around you, and it's a weird world, you know, an exotic world, which you're trying to get to grips with. And you're very attuned, particularly emotionally attuned to what's going on. And you'd meet adults who you thought were great and warm and kind and decent, and then others who just gave you the shivers. And again and again, these were the people who were like really disturbing people. I mean, one of them later turned out to have a long record of child abuse, among other things. But it was, so I was tuned into politics, but not at all in the way that my parents were. And in fact, I became extremely suspicious of that brand of politics. And it started with that sort of personal revulsion that there was something very wrong here. And as I learnt more, I began to see that, you know, this was a dysfunction which was kind of a societal dysfunction, that we're governed by people who have a sort of, see themselves as having almost a birthright, a sort of an entitlement to rule, who all appear to be profoundly damaged. There's something very wrong, and that there's some sort of retributive character to this, that this damage which appears to have been inflicted on them is something that they then seek to inflict on other people. And I see that to this day. You know, the cabinet today, I mean, the Prime Minister is a classic example. I see him as a very damaged man. All this sort of vagueness and eccentricity which is celebrated in the upper classes, you know, once you've seen through that, you see it's a guise. It's a defensive shield behind which there's any number of lies and deceptions going on. And that there's this profound damage meted out, often, you know, to children in that position, sent away very early to boarding school, as indeed I was, where I bumped into a lot of other very damaged people. And I think in that situation, you have a choice. You know, you either spend your life trying to undo the damage and unlearn the harm, or you spend your life multiplying the harm and projecting the damage and harming other people in your turn. And so, you know, when you're confronted with that choice, it's like you can't be neutral in the face of it. You have to go one way or the other. You have to go with it, or you have to fight it. And me and my sister, we both decided to fight it.
What do you think has changed in the last couple of decades with the Conservative Party more specifically? Obviously, the ideologies have stayed the same and what they stand for, but in terms of the culture of politics and the culture of the Conservative Party, especially now that they've come back into leadership, Has much changed, or do you think they're probably just a bit more exposed now?
It is more blatant, isn't it? I mean, it's like almost a sort of ideological commitment to harmful practice, to dirty money, to environmental destruction, to social destruction. I mean, there's recently this case where an ex-minister was saying that he was instructed to drop his attempts to stop money laundering in the City of London. Because that was cutting across the interests of Conservative Party donors, presumably. You know, there's very strongly established links between that party and dirty money. In fact, to be fair, between the political establishment in general and dirty money. There was plenty of it swirling around Blair's government as well. I see this as resulting from what I call the pollution paradox. And the pollution paradox is as follows. It's the most antisocial corporations and oligarchs who have the greatest interest in spending money on politics, in other words, on funding political parties, because if they don't, they will be regulated out of existence. And as a result of that, it's the most antisocial interests who come to dominate politics. So because of that funding arrangement, you end up with the worst possible people in charge. They're the ones who are projected into positions of power because the money supports them. And I don't just mean the donors. I also mean the billionaire media magnates who appear to have the most antisocial tendencies, the most destructive tendencies. And they want people who will implement their agenda, which is antisocial and destructive. And so we end up dancing to the tune of offshore billionaires and being governed by the playthings of offshore billionaires. I mean, Dominic Cummings said that Boris Johnson calls the Daily Telegraph his real boss, which, of course, it was for quite a while. So Frederick Barclay, the owner of the Daily Telegraph, he's the boss. Well, as is Rupert Murdoch, as is Lord Rothermere, none of whom are domiciled in this country for tax purposes.
You're right, George. I think it's very interesting to see how the interests of our leaders have got nothing to do with the people like ourselves, doctors, in the case of COVID, and the interests are so far-fetched, so far removed from what we really need. You just wonder, you know, will we ever see the changes we want to see if this is the cycle that will continue? Earlier you mentioned that you'd gone to boarding school and you didn't feel like you'd fit into that sort of crowd. And I read somewhere that you mentioned you were trying to fake illnesses and you were trying to sort of get your way out of it. What was that like, George, to have such a big imagination, so many ideas, so many things you wanted to change, yet the people you were in school with didn't align with those values? How did you feel at such a young age?
It was, it was a very difficult time for me, particularly in my first boarding school. I went there when I was 8, as I say. I didn't know that I was going to boarding school. So when my parents drove away, I asked someone, when are they coming back? And they said, oh, in 3 weeks. I said, well, what? And then it was just like for a day, you know, and I'd see them. And I just was completely unprepared. I mean, I was quite an introverted child. I had intense interests, a great love of the natural world. I was sort of fascinated by how things worked, fascinated by how society worked, as well as how the living world worked. And I was in this place, it seemed lost. It belonged to another era. So all the dormitories were named after people who were by then considered war criminals, Kitchener and Haig, people like that. The history we were taught was all about how the heroic British people went and fought those black and brown bastards and put them in their place. And it was all the Siege of Khartoum and the Black Hole of Calcutta and all that. And the geography books still, you know, they were decades out of date, and they still showed sort of a huge tracts of the world coloured pink, the British Empire. And at the time it was, I mean, it was disorienting because, I mean, I can't claim to have arrived in a position of knowledge, but even as an eight-year-old, it was, there's something weird about this. We're celebrating mass killing. You know, the mass killing of lightly armed people, if they were armed at all. You know, what's going on here? This is, it's weird. And, you know, why are the textbooks showing us something which isn't the case anymore? But much later, I think I began to understand what that was all about. That these schools were established to create a kind of kamikaze caste of young men. They would break their attachments to family and home and all the other things that you are attached to as a child, and reattach you instead to empire, to the army, maybe to the church, but the other sort of institutions of the establishment. And because you had no other attachments, you would become fanatically loyal to those institutions. And you wouldn't question them, and you wouldn't question what they were doing. And so you could immediately be recruited to commit atrocities on behalf of these ideals which were instilled into us all the time. So we had a prayer in school chapel, which was, let us now pray for famous men. And they would list this list of people, you know, whose statues we now want to pull down, because they were all the sort of the people who committed crimes against humanity in parts of the British Empire. I mean, it was, you know, this grisly list, and or sent hundreds of thousands of men over the top in the trenches in the First World War. I mean, it really was a selection of the worst people just about who have ever existed in this country. But those were the people that we were supposed to worship. But of course, by 1971, when I was sent to this school, the empire had gone, despite Britain's brutal efforts to keep hold of it. The government was in the hands of enemies, you know, in that it was no longer at that point the traditional ruling class that seemed to be in charge. Of course, they've reasserted that control now. The army didn't count for very much anymore. The church was a joke. So all the institutions, the establishment's institutions, this school was set up to feed, and to feed this kamikaze caste of young men which it was going to produce into. Those had gone as far as its interests were concerned, and yet it was still teaching this old Victorian rubbish, which just couldn't equip us for what was actually going on in the world. And there was this sense, looking back on it, it just seemed sad and lost, like an island of nostalgia in a world that had moved on. And so again, there's that choice there. Either you go with that and you try to force the world back into that box, as I believe many of those currently in charge of this country are trying to do, or you say, to hell with all that, it's bollocks. I chose the latter.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of the leaders we see currently come from, their history involves a lot of damage, personal damage, emotional damage. And I wonder, do you think sending them to boarding school sort of amplifies that emotional distress and personal damage? Because I read the book Sad Little Men, and to read how these kids would only meet their parents maybe on a Sunday evening for a couple of hours if they were lucky, or the times that they had with their families was during the summertime, or they'd go to a nice holiday. So the times they had with their parents was in a fantasized way. They were in a nice sunny place, or they were skiing in a resort and then they'd come back to school. So they never actually had a connection, a real connection with their parents. Do you think sending them to boarding school, and maybe even with your case as well, do you think it creates a lot of emotional damage that either never gets resolved or takes years and decades to undo?
It's huge. The psychotherapist Joy Shaverian came up with this term, boarding school syndrome, because she saw again and again the same symptoms manifesting people who've gone through that system with a set of symptoms which I think she compared to those of children who've been taken into care, except in some cases worse. Because in this case, you knew that the abandonment was elective. It wasn't like your parents had no choice. And it takes a lifetime of love and therapy to overcome that. And if you don't go through that, and if you don't deliberately seek to overcome it, then the damage persists and it amplifies, because as time goes on, actually things get worse, they don't get better if they're not addressed. And so even if the school itself was some lovely place where everyone looked after you and there was no bullying and no one had their head stuffed down the toilet, even if all that were true, which I'm afraid it in most of these places was absolutely not the case. There was no pastoral care whatsoever, and it was dog eat dog and worse. The very abandonment and that sort of loss of your attachments and connections was itself profoundly damaging. And you know, there's been a huge amount of work now. People like Nick Duffel and many others sort of documenting the enormous harm that this system does. But on top of that was the fact that these schools, of course, were very far from being caring communities. And in my school, it was sink or swim. In fact, literally, when it came to swimming lessons, if you couldn't swim, you were thrown in the deep end. And which was kind of a metaphor for the whole school.
Yeah, for life.
And the system. Yes, exactly. And bullying was, it was considered character forming. In fact, the whole thing was considered character forming, but it's not. And I think, you know, alongside all the crazy things I've mentioned, I think that there was a fundamental misapprehension at the heart of it, which is that, you know, they knew that physical hardship makes you physically tough. You know, this as you know, the army training shows, you know, you put people through extreme physical hardship and they do get physically tough. And so there was a sort of extrapolation from that. So emotional hardship must make you emotionally tough, but it doesn't. It does the opposite. It makes you highly vulnerable and weak. And it creates this sort of kink, in your brain, which ensures that you are constantly subject to perverse desires which undermine your own well-being, you know, where you just want power, you want wealth, you want things which actually aren't going to solve your problems. You know, when I see Donald Trump, I just see someone who's almost the epitome of those perverse desires, where it's like he's obviously got something very badly wrong, but he thinks he can fill that hole by becoming president, by having loads of money, by having a giant tower with his name written on gold in gold letters. But you can't, because that hole cannot be filled by those means. It can only be filled by love and by therapy. It can't be filled with all these extrinsic trinkets, even the presidency of the United States. So he becomes president and he's still furious and he's still full of resentment and rage, because the resentment and rage comes from a different place and can only be healed from a different place. And so I see all these people coming out of this system with these perverse desires which translate into this powerful, overwhelming need to dominate other people. So in a way, I've been equipped with something powerful myself. I mean, I don't want that power or any of those trappings at all, but I've been able to see it. You know, because I was brought up in that system, the aspects of the system which other people might find mystifying, you know, I understand them. And other people say, oh, so look at these sort of funny blokes, you know, with their vagueness and their eccentricity and oh, aren't they charming? Aren't they hilarious? No, that vagueness, that eccentricity, those are the masks that people wear. And underneath that, there is layers and layers of damage and lies, deception, and all the other tricks you learn to cope with the situation that you're in as a child.
Would you say that what you went through as a child, I would say the trauma of going into boarding school and being part of the system that you didn't want to be a part of, do you think part of your healing and part of your processing has been by writing and by carrying out your activism work? Do you think that's played a huge role in overcoming all of that trauma?
Yes. Yeah. No, it has been part of it. I mean, I can't say that that's the mainspring of it, because I think the most important thing is love, and that's what gets you through life ultimately. You know, the love of your family, the love of your friends. That's the only thing which can heal. But as a way of understanding, of working through it, of saying, what is this weird system which I found myself born into and which I lived through? What is it? Why does it work like this? What's going on here? And what does it do to other people? How does it affect society as a whole? In a way that is therapeutic, but also it's enlightening. And it allows me to understand that, yeah, it didn't just happen to me or to any single person. It's happening to the whole country. Because, you know, what the people who seek to dominate us went through is something which they push everybody through, because it's like the projection of the harm that's going on. And I see that almost, well, as part of my mission. Obviously the environmental part is huge for me as well, but it's like I've been equipped with this tool. I have this tool of understanding because I was there. I was a witness. I saw it firsthand. I saw how it worked, and much of my life has been spent understanding it, unlearning the bad stuff as best as I can, and understanding it and trying to explain it to other people. And I think in doing so, I can do some good. I can undo some of that harm.
George, I remember when I first protested outside Downing Street, and just like you, what I saw happening in front of my eyes, I felt it was so wrong on so many levels. And I had like a visceral feeling of sickness every time I'd walk into the hospital, thinking, how is our government allowing all of this to happen? I think the biggest point for me was when I attended one of the funerals of the healthcare worker who passed away, Nurse Mary Ajipong, and I saw that impact it had on her whole family. And in my head, I was thinking, this is one nurse. Multiply that by 200, 300 healthcare workers who died. It's just not okay. And those emotions made me go through the process of protesting and taking the government to court. And through that process, I realized that I was able to channel that energy into creating some change. And I think I was quite lucky in one sense, George, because I feel like we were all in a vacuum of the pandemic. People wanted to listen to doctors. People cared about the NHS. I think the media was kind of on my side at that time, and I was quite lucky. How do you think the media landscape has changed? Because you've been working on so many different things over decades. Do you think the media has helped you, or have you had to fight the media to get your word out as well?
Well, I mean, I don't want to generalise about it, because there are some parts of the media which have definitely been easier to work in than others. And The Guardian has given me a very good platform for a long time now, and lets me write whatever I want to write. And obviously, you and I, we're part of the media, and it's a good part of the media. But on the whole, I would say it is the most damaging of all industries, because it provides the social license which enables the other damaging industries and activities and politics in this country to persist and to grow. And it's obvious that, you know, the billionaire press leads that, the newspapers and other outlets owned by Murdoch and Barclay and Rothermere, who, you know, are the real power in the land, I think. But sadly, I think the BBC, in its news and current affairs, to a large extent, echoes and amplifies their message and has become extremely hostile most of the time to the sort of messages which I think people need to hear. It's BBC News and Current Affairs is very bad at analysing and explaining what's really happening. It's led by sensation. It's seeking to create noise all the time, which is the antithesis of the deep understanding that we require. But also it's just dominated to a large extent by the agenda of the billionaires, which is driven through their newspapers. And they hate the NHS. They hate public service. They hate the public sector. And they hate them because they want to sweep away anything which stands between them and the pursuit of raw profit. And any part of the economy which is in the hands of the public is a part of the economy which is not in their hands. And so they see it as a mortal enemy. It's something that doesn't belong to them. It is a source of resistance. It's an opportunity for profit which has not yet been captured. And so while there are moments when they celebrate the NHS, and the beginning of the pandemic was one of those, most of the time they're trying to undermine and break it up, and constantly harping on about its failings and how much more wonderful a private system would be. Or, you know, they do it subtly because they can't just say we want to privatise the NHS, but very obviously they want to privatise the NHS. And they've put in place a government which is going to try to do that for them and is already some way down that line. And thanks to 12 years of austerity, the extreme underfunding that's caused, you know, you're the last person I need to tell this to, but, you know, we now know, you know, better than anyone that, you know, public services hang together on the goodwill of the people who work there now. You know, if everyone worked only the hours they were paid for, they would collapse overnight. Yeah, and it's goodwill and sticky tape is keeping this whole country together. But it can't be sustained. You know, I'm sure you know from many colleagues about how quickly people are now burning out, how difficult it is to just keep going in such hostile circumstances. And I applaud you both for your, you know, work as a doctor, but also for getting the message out there and taking it to Downing Street and saying this is a political matter. You know, you know, the government creates a situation that makes it impossible for doctors to do their job and nurses to do their job and teachers and administrators and council workers and frontline workers of all kinds to do their job in the way they want to do their job. And that's by design. It's not by accident.
You mentioned about how the media has been good in some ways and hasn't been so great in other ways. And one thing that I admire about everything that you've done is how you don't really care about the consequences. At least you didn't when you were younger. You just went out and you just fought for what you believed in. You got a microphone, you stood in the streets and you spoke your heart out. And one thing that I found very interesting was what had happened in Indonesia. I know you went to Indonesia to do some investigation, and through that you wrote a book called Poisoned Arrows. But I know that the Indonesian government weren't very chuffed about everything that you did. So can you please just tell us a little bit more about what happened there?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I was completely mad when I was in my 20s. I think I did have a bit of a death wish, to be honest. But I was just obsessed with trying to discover what was going on, trying to sort of get to what I saw as the truth of the matter. And as a result, you know, I the only thing I wanted to do was to become an investigative journalist. That seemed to me, it's like, so, you know, you just have to tell the truth, and you can't get to the truth without that investigative aspect. And in fact, the only proper job I ever had was the job I got straight out of university at the BBC, where I hammered on their doors until I was told, literally, these are the exact words, "You're so fucking persistent, you can have the job." Because what I was pointing out to them was, you've got no investigative environmental programming at all. And bring me in and I will give you investigative environmental programming. And I just bombarded them with all the stories that I wanted to investigate and stuff. And so they let me in, which is probably rash. And for 2 years, I did it, and it worked really well. And the team we put together cracked some fantastic stories. One of them made international news. We picked up awards. It was all looking great. And then that was from 1985 to 1987. In January 1987, Thatcher launched her coup against the BBC and forced the Director General, Alastair Milne, to resign. And the very next day, my boss came in and said, right, that's it, no more investigative journalism. I said, what? And he said, no, I've had it from the top, no more investigative journalism in the BBC. I said, but that's journalism. You can't have journalism if it's not investigative. He said, it's out of my hands. I'm just relaying what we're told. I said, so what am I going to do? He said, I don't know. And it was, and he was right. That was the directive. And the BBC has never recovered from that moment. You know, it still does some good stuff. You know, every so often there's a really good programme. But, you know, people would not believe what that organisation was like before 1987. It was a really gutsy organisation which was just going to go out and get them. I mean, that's why Thatcher moved against it, because it had produced series like Maggie's Militant Tendency, showing how many of her front benchers used to be fascists when they were young. It produced Secret Society, showing all this unauthorised government spending on spy satellites and other stuff which hadn't been approved by Parliament. I mean, it really went for it. It really went for the jugular. And it's just been completely disciplined since then. And it just gets worse every year. And so at the time, I was working on this extraordinary story, this thing going on in Indonesia where, with the help of the US and UK governments and the World Bank, the Suharto dictatorship, one of the most brutal dictatorships on earth, but a great, great friend of the West, was moving hundreds of thousands of people from Java and Bali out to the remote parts of Indonesia, which was this vast archipelago, including its occupied territories of East Timor and West Papua, which remains occupied. Ostensibly to relieve population pressure in Java and Bali, but that wasn't what it was about at all. It was about creating a security state ranging across this whole archipelago, all sort of, you know, in the excuse of stopping communism from entering, but actually just about consolidating the rule of this Western-backed dictatorship across this huge arc covering So you know, this all the way from Sumatra to West Papua. And so with my friend the photographer Adrian Arbib, I said, well, to hell with this. If the BBC's not going to do it, I'm going to leave the BBC and I'm going to take it to a publisher. And I managed to persuade a publisher to fund me to write a book about it. And we went off into this totally impossible situation. I mean, no foreigners were allowed into West Papua at all. That's where we decided to go because that's where we thought the epicentre of it all was, and I think we were right. And we just couldn't get in. You know, there was no legal route by which we could get in, and we spent 2 weeks in the police headquarters in Jakarta just going from office to office trying to get this thing called a Surat Jalan, a travel pass to go to West Papua. Couldn't do it. And then one day, I was walking down this corridor, having been in this interminable queue. I went off to get a glass of water, and I saw this door which was ajar, and it said Head of Immigration Police on the door. And I thought, I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to persuade him. That's what I'm going to do. I knocked on the door. There was no answer. I pushed the door open and there was no one there, but on the desk was a pad of headed notepaper and a stamp. I thought, well, that'll do. And so we forged ourselves a pass and got into West Papua that way. But it was immensely hazardous because while it got us through quite a few police and army checks, And while we used it, when we basically walked across the entire island to get to where we wanted, it took 4 weeks of walking. Halfway through, we got stopped at an army checkpoint, and the guy said, "No," he said, "I don't believe this." He said, this isn't real." I said, "Of course it's real." He said, no, "This isn't real. Right. I'm putting you under arrest, and I'm going to hold you till I have checked with Jakarta that this is real." And this Jakarta was like over 2,000 miles away, you know, and it was like, oh God, he's going to shoot us. You know, it's inevitable. It's just inevitable that we were going to get shot. And so, we were sort of held in this sort of little wooden hut, and for 3 days, and we could hear them on the radio, just hear them trying to get through, and they couldn't get through. They couldn't get through to Jakarta, and you can imagine the tension. You know, my hair was coming out in clumps, and eventually the guy says, "Fuck it, off you go," and let us go. We couldn't believe it because they couldn't make the connection. And so we walked through the forest, we canoed down the rivers, we got to places which no foreigners were supposed to see, and we were able to tell this horrendous story of this sort of Western-backed genocidal scheme that was taking place there, with basically the replacement of the indigenous people with the right sort of people from Java and Bali, and the mass ecological destruction that went alongside that as well. We wrote that up as my first book, which was called Poisoned Arrows.
You've been around the world, you've been to different parts of societies and different types of communities as well. And you did all of this at a very young age. Did it come at a personal cost at all? Or were you just so in love with what you were doing that it didn't really matter?
I mean, it was my mission. It was the thing that counted for me. And, you know, at that age, I didn't have any ambition to have a family life. My relationships were a bit of a disaster. I was just so focused. I just had this urge. I need to know what's happening, and I need to tell other people what's happening. And, you know, and since then I've discovered family life, and I discovered what good relationships look like, and all that. It's taken me a while, but, you know, I got there in the end. And so, you know, I'm lucky enough to have that in my life, but also still have this powerful need to discover what's going on and tell other people. And obviously, you know, I can't now throw myself into situations like that. I've got children, and also, you know, it is a young person's game. That it really is. You know, as you get older, you just get tired. You can't hack the idea of spending 6 months in the rainforest hiding, which was basically what we did. You know, we hid for 6 months, and the fear and the anxiety and the sheer terror and that involves, that is a young person's game. So what I've tried to do is to reconcile this need to my more sedentary life now, and to use a skill which I turn out to have, which is to be able to read phenomenal quantities of material and make sense of them. And I'm very lucky to have that, and it works well for me. So, I mean, the latest book I've written, I read over 5,000 scientific papers, among other sources, as part of my research, and did a lot of field work as well. But I have this ability to read an awful lot. I don't get tired in the way that other people seem to. And so I feel, well, now my duty is to use that. That's my quest at the moment, and maybe it'll change, and, you know, I'll interpret the quest in a different way. But in every case, it's all about trying to get to the heart of the matter.
I think that's really beautiful, George. The fact that we know now that change can be created in so many different ways, and you can get from point A to B in different ways. You don't actually have to go into the hands of the Indonesian police anymore. You can still sit at home and create change on not just a local level, but on a global level as well. What are your thoughts on activism now? And I say this just going back to what I was saying earlier, that I was quite lucky earlier when I protested, because we were in that vacuum of the pandemic. And now with the internet, things go viral within minutes. And it seems like you can get your message out a lot quicker than maybe you would have been able to do all those years ago. But I feel at the same time, it's sort of a counterbalance where you have people who oppose what you say, and they can also go viral in the same time frame. So you can never really find that balance. So what are your thoughts on that, George? I mean, do you think that the internet has helped us, or do you think it's caused more damage?
I mean, it definitely cuts both ways. There's no question about that. I think social media gets a bad rap in a lot of ways. I mean, I use Twitter a lot.
I know you do, George.
And in fact, as you say, that's how we met. Yes, that's right. And I find it amazing. I mean, once you've blocked about 500 people, then suddenly it's a really nice place to be. It's the same people again and again who just make it a miserable place. But you block them, and then suddenly it's like, oh, this is a great medium for exchanging ideas, testing out arguments, thinking aloud, exchanging information, especially, you know, I'll try out an idea or a thought I'm having, and then people will say, oh yeah, but have you thought about this? And look, there's this amazing paper published in Geophysical Research Letters. Have you seen it? And it's like, suddenly you've got all these great sources of information and of ideas. And also you've got people saying, no, you're wrong about this. Actually, you're not seeing it right. You've missed something crucial. And so you have all the eyes and ears which help you to refine your thinking and expand your circle of thought. And I think that's a really fantastic function. And it also acts as a mirror, you know, where it says, you know, it allows you to reflect on what you're saying, because if there's a flaw in your argument, it will be immediately discovered. Immediately. And I find that a very good thing. You know, it's like, some people get very angry when the flaws in their argument are discovered, but it's like, yeah, you know, I sometimes get upset if I made an idiot of myself, but you know, I'm actually grateful when someone says, no, you know, you have got this wrong and I can show it. You know, obviously, if it's someone just saying, no, you're an idiot, you know, and not providing their reasoning and not coming up with the sources of information which they need to demonstrate that, then obviously it's not constructive. But, you know, this sort of constructive disagreement, I think, is absolutely crucial. And it can be a really important part of that, of civic life, of democratic engagement. But at the same time, it can create this illusion that you've changed something by writing a viral tweet, you know, and it's part of change, and it's definitely part of it, but it's not enough. You know, we need structural change, we need systemic change, and the conversation is part of that. But any effective movement has to be an ecosystem, and it needs people operating at all levels. You know, the people, practitioners like yourself, actually making a difference on the ground day by day. But also, like yourself, talking about it and explaining it and exposing where things are going wrong. We need the people on the street. And sometimes that's me, and sometimes that's you, you know, but as well as the other things we do. But we also need all the unsung people. I mean, every movement, however radical, has to have its accountants and its administrators and its typesetters and its lawyers and its tea makers, and you know, it needs a whole range of skills. It needs a huge number of people all working together, bringing their own special skills to bear on trying to make change, political change. And there haven't yet been enough of us. You know, there's a lot of wonderful, amazing, committed people, but there's quite a large body now of both observational work and experimental work showing that systemic change happens when you've got 25% of the population on board in a committed fashion. That doesn't necessarily mean 25% of the population on the streets, but committed to change, who have sort of seen the need for something to change, who understand that need, who roughly know what they're talking about. And then the whole thing can move very quickly. And we've seen some remarkable shifts in recent years. You know, if you look at attitudes to gay marriage, for example, you know, the enormous change in perceptions there, which was driven, first of all, by a very small core of people, and then it got bigger, and then it got bigger, and then it seemed to reach that threshold of about 25% of the population saying, yeah, that's all right with me. And then suddenly it becomes unstoppable. Things flip. And that's what needs to happen on a whole series of issues. And it can, you know, this isn't, we're not talking about the impossible here, not by any means at all. We're talking about things which are entirely possible. You know, as David Graeber said, you know, it's people who create these systems, it's people who can change them.
At this stage in your life where you've created so much change, you've inspired so many people around the world, you've written so many books, so many papers, you're at a stage in your life now where you've achieved more than anybody probably has in their lifetime, and people would dream to be able to achieve everything that you have. So what's next for you now? What are you looking to do over the next few years? Are you looking to write more books? Are you going to bring your daughter on your bandwagon with with all your work as well? Like what are your plans?
That's going to be up to her. I have got another book coming out in May called Regenesis, Feeding the World Without Devouring the Planet. And it's about this really fascinating and absolutely crucial issue of how we produce our food. And it has to change. It has to change radically, because food production is the greatest cause of habitat loss, the greatest cause of species loss, the greatest cause of fresh water use, one of the greatest causes of greenhouse gas production, and the greatest cause of land use. And it is just driving environmental catastrophe, but it's also failing to feed people effectively. Since 2015, the number of hungry people on Earth has been rising. And a lot of the great improvements which have been made in nutrition are now going into reverse. This is a catastrophe. So we've got a system which is causing environmental disaster, but it's also not working in humanitarian terms, and that needs to change radically. And so what I try to explore in this book is how that can best be done, and there's some really exciting ways forward. And in fact, I'm also trying to work on the scientific research side as well, bringing together people from different disciplines to launch this thing I've got in mind called the Earth Rover Program. We've got a Mars Rover Program, right? But you know, wouldn't it be better to have a better idea of what's going on this planet than one which doesn't have the advantages of 1G of gravity and one bar of atmospheric pressure and oxygen and radiative screening and other quite useful things like that. And what one of the things we desperately need is finally to map the world's soils, because we can't have a sustainable agriculture without proper soil mapping. And so I'm working on bringing together an interdisciplinary team and to try to move towards a sort of global thing that I call the Earth Rover Program. So watch this space.
Wow, that's amazing, George. I can't wait to see what you've got in store over the next few years. And I just want to say thank you for not just coming on the podcast, but over the last few years to be my guiding light. I know that we've only really met recently, but to see all the work that you've done and the books that I've read that you've written, if it wasn't for that, I don't think I would have had any of the confidence to go outside Downing Street. So thank you.
Well, thank you for everything you're doing. And it's been an honour to talk to you, Meenal. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week for another lovely episode. And thank you, George, for giving me your time. I'm sure a lot of people will take a lot of wisdom from this episode. I've left George's website and the link to pre-order his new book, Regenesis, in the show notes. And I've also left his social media accounts there. So please give him a follow, and I'm sure you'll learn a lot more from him. If you are listening to this episode on iTunes, please do leave a review. In fact, if you're on any podcast app, please leave a review. It does help us reach out to more people. You can drop me a message on Instagram or on Twitter at Dr. Meenal Viz, and you can tell me what you think about these episodes and if there's anybody in particular you'd like me to interview. You can also subscribe to my newsletter, which is on my website. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, it won't take longer than 60 seconds to subscribe. And in the newsletter, I hope to share more wisdom and more learnings from my guests on this podcast. So thank you to George. Thank you to everybody who's tuned in again this week. I'll be back next Friday.